This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.
Thank you very much. Good evening. Yeah, so... Oy vey. It's a bad sign.
No, it's not.
It's plastic. It's okay. Anyway, so King Saul, one death, five accounts. You know, most people die only once. Some people do more than that, but most people do die once, but there's no limit to the accounts about one's death. In the book of Samuel, we have two accounts, as you see in your handouts. One account is in 1 Samuel chapter 31, and the second one in 2 Samuel chapter 1, the following chapter actually. You know that in the Hebrew Bible, actually, we have one book of Samuel. The whole idea of dividing the book of Samuel into two books, it's a late idea, not our invention. The book of Samuel is one book, and when the Chazal, for instance, not only Chazal, but also Josephus Flavius and then Chazal, when they count the books of the Bible, for them, the book of Samuel is one book, the book of Kings is one book, the book of Chronicles is one book. Anyway, so we have two accounts in the book of Samuel. One of them is the one written or told by the narrator, who is the supreme authority. He is the one whom we have to trust. And the other report is by a person whose claim to fame, or at least he claims that he should get the fame for killing King Saul in 2 Samuel chapter 1. The idea of having two stories, two different stories, two different reports, we are very familiar with it. We are familiar with it in the book of Genesis. We just open the Bible, open the Torah. The first story we have, the creation story, we get two creation stories, and they don't necessarily agree with one another. But there is always should be a reason why do we have two different stories. And the same thing later on, of course, the stories about Abraham and his wife, you know, going to visit different kings, once in the court of Pharaoh and then in the court of Abimelech, king of the Philistines. Very similar story about the wife, Sarah, being taken by the king, etc. And I could have mentioned more examples in the book of Genesis. And of course, there are also many examples in the book of Samuel. For instance, the two reports that explain the saying, is Saul too among the prophets, Hagam Shaul Baneviim? Or we have two stories, for instance, about David who has a chance to kill Saul. 1 Samuel chapter 24, 1 Samuel chapter 26, very similar to one another. David is even being encouraged to do it, and he refuses because Ki mi shalach yado bi Mashiach Adonai venika, one does not kill the anointed one, etc. And again, we have to ask ourselves, why do we have two stories? Are these two stories related to one another? Are they independent traditions? Is one of them interpreting the other? What's the point of view of the different stories? Is the same point of view or a different one? And these are the questions we have to ask. And when there are contradictions between the two reports or the two stories, we have to ask ourselves, was the redactor drunk? Didn't he see that there are contradictions between the stories? Didn't he care about the contradictions? Was something more important for him than the contradictions to deal with? And today we'll deal actually with the story of the death of King Saul. As I said, there are two reports in the book of Samuel, but we get an extra one in the book of Chronicles, 1 Chronicles chapter 10. And then, of course, I'll bring you. You have, since most of you have come here tonight very early, you have already read the whole handout, so you know that I bring also texts from Josephus and Antiquities of the Bible, and already you know the whole spiel. Anyway, the story about Saul's death actually starts before the story of Saul's death. because we have to get back at least to 1 Samuel chapter 28, if not 1 Samuel chapter 15. In 1 Samuel chapter 15, that's a story about the war between King Saul and the Amalekites, and Saul did not meet the expectations of God, did not meet the expectations of Samuel, did not kill the king of the Amalekites, and he's doomed. And as I told you already in my first lecture in this series, poor Saul didn't have a chance. He did not have a chance because anyway, kingship is not something that the Bible is fond of. And B, because David is our favorite. And if David is our favorite, somebody has to pay the price, and the one to pay the price is King Saul. So the moment he gets on the stage, we already know he's going to be a failure. It doesn't take much time for us to realize that he is the failure. And since David is the one who survived, and David was the father of a very long line of kings, you can imagine that his PR office is much better than the one of King Saul. And yet, the big surprise is that still we have many traditions in the book of Samuel that looks upon Saul very favorably. And if I talk about the story actually starting in 1 Samuel 28, 1 Samuel 28, the war between Saul and the Philistines is about to start. And Saul does the natural thing. He wants to hear the voice of God to know what to expect. And the poor thing, you know, asks God, but nobody answers him. 1 Samuel chapter 28, verse 6, and Saul inquired of the Lord. It's not on the handout. And Saul inquired of the Lord, but the Lord did not answer him, either by dreams, or by Urim, or by prophets. All legitimate channels are cut off. God is not talking to Saul anymore. Saul, as we learned already at the very end of chapter 15, God rejected King Saul. That's it. And poor Saul, about whom we hear at the beginning of chapter 28, that he himself and Saul had forbidden recourse of ghosts and familiar spirits in the land of Veid-Oni, he himself, being so very desperate, has no choice at the end, but find me, he tells his courtiers, find me a woman who consults ghosts so I can go to her and inquire through her. That's a real tragedy. You know, the man who knew so very well that this kind of people should not be allowed and did everything to get rid of them, I'm using clean language, at the end, being so desperate, he had no choice but to go and consult one of these ladies. And he disguised himself. And you know the story. Such a beautiful story. I think immediately about Shaul Chernichovsky, who, of course, wrote this beautiful poem about Shaul in Ein Dor. Shaul Chernichovsky, by the way, was highly interested in King Saul because they share the same first name. And it's always like that, you know. For instance, the Hameshoreret Rachel, the poet Rachel, wrote about Rachel from the book of Genesis. Josephus Flavius, when he talks about Joseph, he gives Joseph much more space than he gives any other character. Yeah, it's a psychological phenomenon, I guess. I won't tell you what I've done with Yair, but yeah, I'll hide it from you. Anyway, so poor Saul goes to visit this woman, and he tells her, bring up Samuel for me. And Samuel does appear, and Samuel tells him that that's it, he's doomed. The Lord has done for himself as he foretold to me. The Lord has torn the kingship out of your hands and has given it to your fellow, to David. because you did not obey the Lord and did not execute his wrath upon the Amalekites. That's why the Lord has done this to you today. Further, the Lord will deliver the Israelites who are with you into the hands of the Philistines. Tomorrow, your sons and you will be with me. And the Lord will also deliver the Israelites' forces into the hands of the Philistines. So, and that's what makes the first report about the death of King Saul so very beautiful and tragic. Because Saul knows very well what's going to happen. He knows that tomorrow he'll be dead and all his three sons will be dead with him. And yet he is a king. He's obliged to go and to fight. He'll do it. And that's now how the story starts. You know, so despite the death sentence, Saul goes and fights the Philistines. And now we get to chapter 31. The Philistines attacked Israel, and the men of Israel fled before the Philistines, and many fell on Mount Gilboa. The Philistines pursued Saul and his sons, and the Philistines struck down Jonathan, Abinadab, and Malchishua, sons of Saul. The battle raged around Saul, and some of the archers hit him, and he was severely wounded. Yeah, Vayechal, or Vayachel, there are two actually different ways to read this word. One of them, according to one of them, he was afraid. According to the one, to the other reading, he was severely wounded. Chole, Vayechal. Anyway, Saul said to his arms bearer, draw your sword and run me through, so that the uncircumcised may not run me through and make sport of me. Yeah, his great fear, he was not afraid to die. He was afraid that the uncircumcised, they would have the satisfaction of killing the king of Israel. He wanted his arm bearer to kill him because he cared so very much about the honor of the people of Israel and perhaps about the honor of the God of Israel. And this story reminds us, of course, about some other guy who cared about the uncircumcised, and that's Samson. And you remember the story about Samson killing 1,000 Philistines in the book of Judges, chapter 15, and after killing them, he was so very proud of himself and stood there and sang this funny song, or even silly song. I am the one who have killed, 1,000 Philistines with a bone of an ass. Yeah. But then he became very thirsty, and he's afraid that he's going to die, and he says to God, you yourself has granted me victory through your servant, and must I now die of thirst and fall into the hands of the uncircumcised? Plishtim ha'areilim. And God, of course, helps him, performs a miracle for him. Water comes out of the rock, and he's drinking, and he's alive and healthy. But this whole incident about Saul asking his arms bearer to kill him, and of course the arms bearer refuses to kill him, and thereupon Saul grasped the sword and fell upon it. When his arms bearer saw that Saul was dead, he too fell on his sword and died with him. Yeah, shows you that how much this servant of his or arm bearer of his respected the king. There is no meaning for my life if my beloved king is dead. Yeah, so you see that this story was written out of great respect to King Saul. King Saul here is a tragic hero, but the narrator really respects him and loves him. But this scene also reminds us of another story. very similar story and yet very different. And I've already told you 100 times that whenever you see similar stories, look for the differences. The most important element actually are the differences between the story. And that's the story about Abimelech, son of Gideon, the one who killed his 70 brothers and made himself king in Shechem. And then there is a war between him and his enemies. And at the end of this war, a woman dropped an upper millstone on Abimelech's head and cracked his skull. He immediately cried out to his attendant, his arm bearer, "Draw your dagger and finish me off, that they may not say of me, 'A woman killed him.'" So his attendant stabbed him. No problem. Of course, you see that Abimelech did not care very much about, you know, the glory of Israel, about God, about anything. But he wanted to make sure that he gets into history properly. Nobody will tell that a woman, there is no bigger humiliation for a general and then to be killed by a woman. You know the story about, for instance, about Deborah and Yael and Sisera, when Deborah agrees to go with him, but tells him, "Lo la derech hazet tiyeh tifartecha ki biyad Adonai imkor Adonai et Sisera," meaning that's will biyad isha imkor Adonai et Sisera, meaning a woman will kill Sisera and not you, so you won't get much glory there. But the funny thing, you see the difference between the two stories, the story of Abimelech and the story of Saul, the difference between the two. And that's why also another difference between these two stories, that Saul's attendant, his arm bearer, would not kill him. He would prefer to kill himself, but he will never kill Saul. And the arm bearers of Abimelech didn't have any difficulty, so he took his dagger and put it into Abimelech's belly, and that was the end of the story. But the irony about Abimelech is that this story became well known in the Israelite West Point, in the officers' academy. They kept telling this story about Abimelech because in 2 Samuel, then 2 Samuel chapter 11, when the army of David is fighting the Ammonites, and you know that when David wanted to get rid of Uriah the Hittite, so they found a way to make Uriah getting close to the wall, so people will shoot him from the wall, etc. After Uriah is killed, actually, people are a little afraid to tell David what happened because other people got killed, so what will he say? Well, perhaps he'll be very angry because other people were killed. And then they say, what will happen if he will say, "Why did you come so close to the city to attack it? Didn't you know that they will shoot from the wall? Who struck Abimelech, son of Jerubbaal? Wasn't it a woman that dropped an upper millstone on Abimelech's head?" So it didn't help. People still tell a story about him getting killed by a woman. Poor thing. Anyway, but Saul is presented to us in a very heroic way, and we see how much people appreciated him, how much people loved him. And then we hear, of course, the Saul and his three sons and his arms bearer, as well as all his men, died together on that day. And when the men of Israel on the other side of the valley and on the other side of the Jordan saw that the men of Israel had fled and that Saul and his sons were dead, they abandoned the towns and fled. Philistines then came. And the next day the Philistines came to strip the slain, and they found Saul and his three sons lying on Mount Gilboa. They cut off his head and stripped him of his armor. Awful. And they sent them throughout the land of the Philistines to spread the news in the temples of their idols and among the people. Of course, that's the way you do it in the Middle East. Or at least that's the way you did it in the Middle East. Well, yeah, it's still being done. But for instance, you remember the story about the Philistines taking the Ark of God in captive, you know, and they bring it to the house of Dagon. And of course, the house, the Aron, the Ark, has its own way to fight back and causes a lot of damage. And Dagon falls down before the Ark of the Lord. So anyway, we win the story, that story. But you know also the story about David and Goliath. What the sword of Goliath is then being put in the temple in Nob. And when David is on an escape from King Saul, he stops there in Nob and asks for a weapon. And the only weapon they have to give him is actually the sword of Goliath, which was there before the Lord. That's where you bring your assets. Anyway, so they cut his head, blah blah blah, and took it to their temples of their idols and mocked the people. They placed his armor in the temple of Ashtaroth, and they impaled his body on the wall of Beth-an. When the inhabitants of Yavesh-Gilad heard about it, what the Philistines had done to Saul, all their stalwarts and men set out and marched all night. They removed the bodies of Saul and his sons from the wall of Beth-an and came to Yavesh and burned them there. Then they took the bones and buried them under the tamarisk tree in Yavesh, and they fasted for 7 days. Again, to show you how much King Saul was appreciated, the people of Yavesh-Gilad were ready to risk their own lives, not in order to save a living man, but in order to prevent the body of King Saul to be humiliated by the Philistines and to bring it to the Lekever Israel. Yeah, and of course you know of course the story. You remember the story from the book of 1 Samuel chapter 11, the first war of King Saul. When King Saul was still, he was already anointed, but he was still home and he was still like a farmer. And he came back from plowing his field in the evening, and he heard that the Ammonites are putting a siege on Yavesh-Gilad. And he decided to go there and to fight the Ammonites, and he won the battle and he saved Yavesh-Gilad. And the people of Yavesh-Gilad are so very grateful now. And they bring the body of Saul and bury it in Yavesh-Gilad. So, if you ask yourselves, who is behind this story? Of course, the person who wrote this story is a great admirer of King Saul. A great admirer. Because King Saul is a tragic character and yet a great hero. But when we move on to the second story, the story in 1 Samuel chapter 1, which is actually the following story, the following chapter, from what point of view is that story written? After the death of King Saul, David had already returned from defeating the Amalekites. Oh my God, the moment I read this verse, I already know who is behind this story. David killed the Amalekites. Who did not fight the Amalekites? King Saul failed fighting the Amalekites. And David is so much better, so very different from King Saul. David has already returned from defeating the Amalekites. David stayed 2 days in Ziklag. On the third day, a man came from Saul's camp with his clothes rent and earth on his head. And as he approached David, he flung himself to the ground and bowed low. David said to him, "Where are you coming from?" He answered, I've just escaped from the camp of Israel. What happened? Asked David. By the way, this story is so very similar to 1 Samuel chapter 4 about the one survivor who ran from the battlefield to take Eli, the priest, about the great defeat of the Israelites. Yeah, very, very similar. So, yeah. So here, where are you coming from? He answered, I've just escaped from the camp of Israel. What happened? Asked David, tell me. And he told him how the troops had fled the battlefield and that moreover, many of the troops had fallen and died. Also that Saul and his son Jonathan were dead. And here we don't hear about the other sons of King Saul, but about Jonathan, because of course the close relationship, the great friendship between David and Jonathan. And you see how the news are being told gradually. First, we lost the battle. Then many were killed. And then the climax, King Saul and his son Jonathan died. How do you know? David asked the young man who brought him the news. That Saul and his son Jonathan are dead. He asked about them. That's what he cares about. You know, Eli, when he got the news about the great defeat, he asked about the Ark of God. That's what he cared about. The moment he heard that the Ark of God is gone, he dropped dead. And here David cares so very much about Saul and Jonathan. He does not ask only about Jonathan. He asks also about King Saul first, because King Saul is the king. We know that the relationship between David and Saul was a terrible relationship. How Saul was chasing David again and again and trying to kill him. And yet, David is a mensch. Saul was his king, and he's asking about Saul and Jonathan. The young man who brought him the news answered, I happened to be on Mount Gilboa, and I saw Saul leaning on his spear. Some spear, chanit, something very strange, because if I work for the Israeli police, I, of course, immediately pay attention that we have two different weapons here, because in 1 Samuel 31, it was a sword, and now it's a spear. So why is it a spear and not a sword? Of course, there is a good reason for it. Because those of you who remember, again, the troubled relationship between David and Saul know that, for instance, Saul, in 1 Samuel chapter 19, verse 10, Saul was trying to pin David to the wall with his spear. But he eluded Saul so that he drove the spear into the wall. And it happens again and again. With the spear, Saul tried to kill David. And then we have, again, the spear plays a major role in another story, in 1 Samuel chapter 26, one of the stories in which David had a chance to kill Saul. It's nighttime. Saul and his people are asleep. The guards are good for nothing. They fail protecting the king. David gets there and steals the spear and the water jar of King Saul. It was so very easy for him to kill Saul, but he did not do it because, again, Saul is the king, the God's anointed one. He is Mashiach Adonai. So David is presented to us in these stories in such a nice way. And so that's why here the revenge. Yeah, Saul now has a spear, and he's leaning upon his spear, on his spear, and the chariots and horsemen closing in on him. He looked around and saw me, says this young lad, and he called to me. When I responded, at your service, he asked me, who are you? And I told him that I was an Amalekite. Poetic justice. Yeah, you Saul, did not kill the Amalekites. Now an Amalekite will kill you, or at least will claim that he killed you. Then he said to me, "Stand over me and finish me off, for I'm in agony." Ki achazani hashavatz, whatever it means. Anyway, it's nothing to do with the uncircumcised. He's not caring here about the honor of God or the honor of the people of Israel. He's caring only about his own agony. And I'm in agony and I'm barely alive. So I stood over him and finished him off. Finished him off. For I knew that he would never rise from where he was lying. Then I took the crown from his head and the armlet from his arm, the insignia. Nothing here about the weapons of King Saul being taken out, etc. It's about these great symbols, the armlet and the crown. And I've brought them here to my Lord. You are the one who deserves having them. You are the future king. David, and one could have expected David to start dancing. Ha ha, I got rid of my great enemy of King Saul. Now I'm going to be the king of Israel. No, as I said, David is a great mensch. David took hold of his clothes and rent them. And so did all the men with him. And I have mentioned, for instance, last week, I think, that it appears this element appears again and again whenever one of the relatives of King Saul dies, and you expect David to be very happy, he gets very upset and he mourns. The climax of this, the most clear example, is the story about the death of Abner, son of Ner. Because again, when he's being told that Abner died, that Yoav ben Tzeruiah killed Abner, he curses, of course, Yoav ben Tzeruiah, and he has this lament over Abner. And at the end, it's written that all the people of Israel knew that it was not David's idea to kill Abner. I have a problem when things like that are being emphasized again and again and again. Then I start suspecting. But that's my bad nature. You don't have to take me seriously. But please do. So David took hold of his clothes and rent them, and so did all the men with him. They lamented and wept, and they fasted until evening for Saul and his son Jonathan. As for the soldiers of the Lord and the house of Israel who had fallen by the sword. David said to the young man who had brought him the news, "Where are you from?" He replied, "I am the son of a resident alien, an Amalekite." Again, they rub it in, this element, you know, his being an Amalekite again. Saul deserves being killed by an Amalekite. That's the point of view of the writer of this report of this story. "How did you dare," David said to him, "to lift your hand and kill the Lord's anointed?" So you see that this element appears again and again in 1 Samuel 24, in 1 Samuel 26, and here again, Saul's is the Lord's anointed. I think that this element, that so many stories in the book of Samuel mention this element again and again, may explain us a lot about the differences between the kingdom of Israel and the kingdom of Judah. In the kingdom of Judah, we had one house, starting with David, ending with Zedekiah. Of course, there were attempts here and there to get rid of a king, some even successful attempts, but yet the house of David was strong enough. And I think that was the ideology. You know, the king is the Lord's anointed, and you don't kill a king. While in the kingdom of Israel, it was a national sport to kill the kings. Every second month, another colonel takes over, kills the previous king, becomes a king, and we had so many different houses of kings in the kingdom of Israel. And of course, every time it's like following the word of a prophet that brings the news that this house is gone and now we have to come up with a new house of kings. Anyway, I may be wrong, but now after David asks, how did you dare to lift your hand and kill the Lord's anointed? And thereupon David called one of the attendants and said to him, come over and strike him. And you see the parallel between the story about King Saul asking his attendant to kill him, and David, he's not killing this young lad, he's asking one of his attendants now to do the killing, meaning he doesn't want to give this young lad the honor that he, the future king of Israel, is killing him. Let one of the, you know, simple soldiers do it. And the end of the story is, and David said to him, your blood be on your own head. Your own mouth testified against you when you said, I put the Lord's anointed to death. Well, you read this story, and of course you see that there are contradictions between the first story and the second story. And I have no way to bring these two stories into agreement. And I think that also the writer of the second story realized that there is no way to bring these two stories into agreement. And that's why he put these words into the mouth of this guy who claims to have killed the king. Your own mouth testified against you when you said, I put the Lord's anointed to death, whether you have done it or not. Perhaps you are a liar, but who cares? Even if you are a liar, just saying that you have king the Lord's anointed is enough for me to kill you. So perhaps this last sentence in the story is some kind of an attempt to bring this two stories into agreement. The first story, as I said, was told by the narrator, who is the supreme authority. And the second one is told by this guy, this opportunist, who brought the insignia to David and wanted to get a prize, but poor thing, lost his life. Anyway, the difference between these two stories is very clear. If the first one, as we said, was written honoring Saul, respecting him, admiring him, the second one gives the glory, all the glory to David. Look how David behaved, how nobly he behaved when he got the news about the death of King Saul. He did the right thing, and he killed the guy who claimed to have killed King Saul. Now, of course, what I should have done, you have it actually on your handout, is the lament, of course. So, in order to show how great and noble David is, you have this lament that David actually composed over Saul and Jonathan. I'm not going to read the whole lament. I'm sure that most of you know it by heart. At least my generation, we learned it by heart, of course. Not only this chapter, we learned many chapters by heart, and I'm very grateful to my teachers who forced me. I used to complain in those old days, but now I'm very grateful. And nowadays, I think that people don't learn by heart anything anymore, which is pretty bad. It makes their language very poor, and their knowledge of the Bible even poorer. But I'm not complaining. I'm just sharing. I'll just read a couple of verses, because it's so beautiful, so touching. So, a Saul and Jonathan, beloved and cherished. Yeah, David is capable of saying how beloved Saul is. The man who really chased him, who tried to kill him all the time, and yet now he can stand and say, Saul and Jonathan, beloved and cherished, never parted in life or in death. They were swifter than eagles. They were stronger than lions. Daughters of Israel, weep over Saul, who clothed you in crimson and finery and decked your robes with jewels of gold. How have the mighty fallen in the thick of battle? Things like that. So it's a beautiful poem, a beautiful lament, one of the most beautiful pieces of poetry in the whole Bible. And whenever I hear it, it's being read, unfortunately, in all the memorial ceremonies that we go to every year. And whenever I hear it, I am about to cry. When I hear it in Hebrew, not in English.
So read it in Hebrew.
No, I will not. My Hebrew is very poor. anyway, so of course, this lament being put in this context adds to the sincerity of David. Shows you that David really cared, behaved properly. He did not want Saul to die. He was very upset with the death of King Saul. Yeah, so 2 Samuel chapter 1 is written from the point of view of David's supporters. That's very clear. Now we have a problem. No, not me personally. But let's say that I'm now going to compose the book of Chronicles. And I want to start the book of Chronicles with the death of King Saul. Because I want, in the book of Chronicles, I want to tell the story of David. I'm a great admirer of David. The book of Chronicles is. And he doesn't want, the book of Chronicles, or the chronicler, does not want to deal with all the problems, the bloody relationship between Saul and David. So he wants Saul to die, to rest in peace, so he can start his own story about David. And you know that David of the book of Chronicles is a perfect man. Perfect man who cares only about one thing, about the building of the temple and nothing more than that. And all the juicy stories you have in the book of Samuel about the relationships between David and his women, wives, and David and his children, there is nothing about it in the book of Chronicles. So now, if I have to, after 9 interesting chapters of genealogies, 1 Chronicle chapter 1 to 9, actually I enjoy reading them very much. Anyway, after these 9 chapters, I have to start the story with the death of King Saul. The question is, I have 2 versions in the book of Samuel, and the question is, which one I'm going to choose? The natural answer would have been, take 2 Samuel chapter 1. Because there David is presented to us so very nicely. That's the kind of David I want to present, Mr. Perfect. And yet, the author of the book of Chronicles decided to start with 1 Samuel chapter 31, Verteidigt und verbessert, with few changes, but yet he decided to prefer 1 Samuel 31 to 2 Samuel chapter 1. And I have not quoted here the whole thing, but there are some very important changes here. Like verse 6 in 1 Samuel, in 1 Chronicles chapter 10. Thus Saul and his 3 sons and his entire house died together. That's not what's written in the book of Samuel, because in the book of Samuel we hear that all his men died, but not the entire family. Because the book of Chronicles does not want to tell us the story about the way Avner died. He does not want to tell us about the way Saul's other son, Ish-bosheth, the way he was killed and his head was brought to David. Of course, David lamented again and kissed the ones who brought him the bad news. But yet, the book of Chronicles is not interested in these stories. He wanted us to believe that Saul's whole family died there in the battlefield, and David had nothing to do with their death. David was not involved. David did not know nothing. So David can start, a new page in the history of Israel. So that's one major change in the report of 1 Samuel chapter 31, the way it's being brought here. But again, the most important element is the end. Verses 13 and 14 in this story. Saul died for the trespass that he had committed against the Lord in not having fulfilled the command of the Lord. Of course, it brings us back to 1 Samuel chapter 13 first. You remember the story that Samuel tells Saul not to sacrifice, not to start until he gets there. He has to wait for 3 days. Saul waits for 3 days. Samuel does not get there on time. People start, leaving. So Saul had no choice but to sacrifice to God, etc. And then gets Samuel there and gets so very angry and so very upset with him. And of course, one can think also about the story of the Amalekites. But, presenting Saul, b'ma'alo asher ma'al, trespass that he had committed against the Lord, in not having fulfilled the command of the Lord. Moreover, he had consulted a ghost to seek advice and did not seek advice of the Lord. Well, does the chronicler think that we are senile? That we have never read the book of Samuel, that we have not read 1 Samuel chapter 28, where we read that he did try to consult, the dreams and prophets and the Urim, but God was the one who did not answer him, and only then he did what he did. V'gam lish'ol ba'ov lidrosh, lish'ol ba'ov. And you get like a free name derivation, a free covert name derivation of Saul. Saul Shaul hu Sha'al Ba'ov. Now you're expected to remember the name of Saul being associated with consulting the ghosts. Awful. So on the one hand, the author of the book of Chronicles chose the 1 Samuel 31 and not 2 Samuel chapter 1, but yet he made some changes in the story, so we will not adore Saul too much. But still, I'm not happy with the answer. Well, he chose chapter 31, made some changes, it's fine. Why couldn't he choose chapter 1, 2 Samuel chapter 1, and then he wouldn't have had to do it, to make any changes in the story? I think that he preferred chapter 1 Samuel 31 because he did not want David to be at all involved in the story. It all happened when David is not present. David does not know about it, anything. And only then, after Saul is dead and he's gone, totally gone, then the people of Israel approach David and tell him, look, even when Saul was alive, you were the one to lead us to battle, blah, blah, blah. And now we want you to be the king of Israel. But David, since everybody was as suspicious as I am about all these stories, about the relatives of King Saul getting killed and David being so sad and upset about it, they didn't want cynical people like myself to come up with their suspicions again, and that's why I think the author was of Chronicles preferred chapter 31 with the necessary changes, and that's it. Now, still, we still have the contradictions between the story of 1 Samuel 31 and 2 Samuel chapter 1. Of course, yes, I said that the last sentence of 2 Samuel chapter 1 gives you an option to somehow explain the differences, but still, you know, there are still contradictions that have not been solved, like the spear versus the sword, and if the guy was there, what did he know when he was there? Was he aware of what the king has said to his attendant or not? It's very difficult, really, to bring these two stories into agreement. But later generations had their own geniuses that came up. And because, you know, that one of the modes of Midrash we are very familiar with, and we find them already in the Bible, and I've even showed you a couple of weeks ago, that already within the Bible, some reductors, editors, writers, who knows, try to solve contradictions. For instance, if you remember the example I gave you, the end of 1 Samuel 16, when David becomes the house musician of King Saul, and he has to stay there all the time because who knows when Saul will get crazy again, and he has to be ready with his violin to play. And on the other hand, we read in chapter 17 that David was still a shepherd with his father being home. And then comes verse 15 of chapter 17 and solved the contradiction. David was going back and forth. As I said, he was the first commuter in the world. And you see that people did care about contradictions. They did not always solve them, but we have already pretty many examples within the Bible itself. Since the Bible, you know, it's a mosaic, so many different traditions written by so many different people. So, of course, there are contradictions. And here and there we see the efforts, people trying to solve these contradictions. Of course, this process of solving contradictions became more intensified in later literature, in Second Temple literature, and then in rabbinic literature. And here we have good examples of Second Temple literature. And this, the first example is from Josephus. I lost Josephus somehow. I'll find him back. I'll find him. Don't worry. Josephus will not escape. Josephus Flavius. And Josephus Flavius, you are very familiar with Josephus Flavius, one of my best friends. I love his writings, I must say. I don't like his politics. I know he was a traitor. You know that in the youth movement, every year we had the trial of Josephus Flavius. Yeah, that was like a yearly ceremony, having a trial. I was always the lawyer of Josephus Flavius, and yet he was found guilty. I never succeeded actually defending him. But he was such a poor soldier, such a poor general, what he did in the north, and then really became a traitor. And yet his Antiquities of the Bible is a book I love. Sitting in Rome in the first century CE, he writes his Antiquities. Of course, he writes it for the Goyim, for the others. And yet it's clear that Josephus was a good student of the rabbis in Jerusalem. When he was a young man, he was a student of the rabbis in Jerusalem. So many traditions we find in his writings, we find later on in rabbinic literature. And anyway, he has unique traditions, beautiful traditions. So, and the way when he paraphrases the Bible, when he retells the story of the Bible, many times I pay attention, through him, I pay attention to difficulties in the text that I was not aware of. Because I see how he tells the story, I understand he tries to solve some problem here. So he is one of the great parshanim, great mefoshim, if you want, of the Hebrew Bible. So let's read Josephus. He himself, after fighting magnificently and receiving numerous wounds, of course he understands by Achel being wounded, not being afraid, God forbid. So after fighting magnificently and receiving numerous wounds until he could no longer hold out nor endure under those blows, was too weak to kill himself. He really wanted to kill himself, and only because he could not kill himself, he asked his and bade his armor bearer draw his sword and thrust it through him before the enemy should take him alive. But as the armor bearer did not dare to slay his master, Saul drew his own sword himself and fixing it with its point. Well, if you want to make a movie, now you know exactly how it should be done. And fixing it with its point toward him, Saul to fling himself upon it. So far, it's 1 Samuel chapter 31. And now we are going to move into 2 Samuel chapter 1, bringing these two traditions into agreement. But was unable either to push it in or by leaning upon it to drive the weapon home. Then he turned and seeing a youth standing there, asked him who he was, and on learning that he was an Amalekite, begged him to force the sword in, since he could not do it with his own hands, and so procure him such a death as he desired. This he did, and after stripping off the bracelet of gold on Saul's arm and his royal crown disappeared, the armbearer, seeing that Saul was dead, killed himself. You see how the two stories are brought into agreement. Of course, there are still problems. There are still contradictions. Again, the sword against versus the spear, etc. But who cares? You see, the Josephus Flavius liked the two reports very much, did not want to omit either of them, and somehow brought it into agreement. But I'm not sure it's Josephus Flavius who invented this kind of compromise, because we find it also in another book, another source, another independent source that was not relying on Josephus Flavius. I say it that it was not relying on Josephus Flavius. Well, some people can disagree with me, because the book I'm referring to now, Pseudophilo, we don't know exactly when it was written. I know exactly when Josephus wrote his book. I don't know when Pseudophilo. It's called Pseudophilo because it's attributed to Philo of Alexandria. It's attributed falsely to Philo of Alexandria. Nothing to do with him. The poor guy is innocent. He did not write it. And nobody knows who wrote it. And nobody really knows when the book was written. Since I might have already mentioned it, I'm sure I've mentioned it, that we have lost the Hebrew original of this book. We lost the Greek translation of this book. We have only the Latin translation of the Greek translation of the Hebrew text. So it's very difficult from a translation of a translation to guess when a book was written. And on the one hand, this book has many traditions which are so very similar to rabbinic sources. On the other hand, it has traditions that are so very unique, and you don't find any like them anywhere else. So perhaps if I say that it was written in the 1st century CE, 2nd century CE, perhaps I'm right, perhaps I'm wrong, I don't know. Different scholars reach different conclusions, make me very upset and confused. I can't do anything about it. Anyway, if we read the The report of Pseudophilo, we see how similar it is to the report of Josephus. And the Philistines attacked Israel, and Saul went out for battle. And Israel fled before the Philistines. And Saul, seeing that the battle was very fierce, said to his heart, "Why are you strengthening yourself for life when Samuel has announced death for you along with your sons? Why are you trying so hard? It's a lost case already." And Saul said to his armor bearer, "Take your sword and kill me before the Philistines come and abuse me." Again, he cares about the honor of the people of Israel again. And the armor bearer was not willing to lay his hands upon him, but he fell upon his sword without being able to die. You see the exactly what we have seen in Josephus. And he looked behind him. He saw a man running, and he called him and said, "Take your sword and kill me. There is still life in me." And he came to kill him. And Saul said to him, "Before you kill me, tell me who you are." Very important. "Tell me who you are." And he said, and here we have something very new. "Wow. I'm Edabus, son of Agag, king of the Amalekites." Wow. Of course, first of all, you know that rabbinic literature, and again, already I have some examples within the Bible itself and later on in Second Temple literature, we don't like people whose names we don't know. We like giving people identity, name, giving them some history, and this guy who claims that he is the one who has killed Saul, we want to know his name, his history, where he's coming from. And here we get a great story. By the way, here it's Edabus. In other manuscripts, it's Adalios. Okay, the Yos is like a Greek ending. So try to get rid of this Greek ending. And what's the name you get? Adalia. And who's Adalia? One of the 10 sons of Haman. So, of course, who's Haman? Haman is the Agagite. Haman ha'Agagi. Haman is a descendant of Agag. And who is Mordechai? Our beloved Mordechai, a descendant of King Saul. Yes, it's so very fascinating for me that, you know, in such a late period when the book of Esther was written, it was somebody still felt that the honor of the house of Saul has to be saved. The story has to be fixed some one way or another. Saul did not kill Agag, but one of his descendants will kill the arch enemy of Israel, Haman the Agagite. And that's why I prefer to trust the manuscripts in which we have the name Adalios. So here you see the connection between that story and the story of the book of Esther, etc. And so, "I'm Edabus, son of Agag, king of the Amalekites." And Saul said, "Behold, now the words of Samuel have come to pass upon me, because he said, 'He who is born to Agag will be a stumbling block for you. Well, we don't have it in the book of Samuel that Samuel said it this way, that the descendant of Agag will be the one who will kill you, but here we have it. "Now go and tell David." Yeah, see, King Saul, before he dies, he is the one who sends the guy to David. "I have killed your enemy." "And you will say to him, 'Be not mindful of my hatred or my injustice.'" Yeah, so King Saul himself, before he dies, admits to be guilty of hating David. And again, this book, Antiquities of the Bible, I have mentioned it already. I'll mention it again today. I like repeating myself. The story of the death of King Saul is the last chapter of this book, Antiquities of the Bible. It ends with this story. And if you ask yourselves, why does it end there? It starts with the creation of the world. And it ends here. So, one reason can be a heart attack. Or he got bored with the project. Or he was not paid enough for doing the project. But I think that the reason is that the author of this book wanted to write the missing part of the book of Chronicles. Since the book of Chronicles starts with the death of King Saul, he wanted to write the history the way he sees it until the death of King Saul. And he expected, he had the ambition of his book becoming a part of the Hebrew Bible. But Mensch tracht und Gott lacht. At the end it didn't work and his book was not included and we lost the original Hebrew of the book, etc., etc. Very sad. Anyway, now I quoted, you know, the last chapter of the book. Chapter is chapter 65 from which we have just read. But here I quote another paragraph from the book from chapter 58. And this is the chapter in which Samuel sends Saul to fight the Amalekites, meaning 1 Samuel chapter 15. And in that time, the Lord said to Samuel, "Go and say to Saul, you have been sent to destroy Amalek in order that the words of the words that Moses, my servant, spoke may be fulfilled." And Saul went off and attacked Amalek, and he let Agag, the king of Amalek, live, because he said to him, "I'll show you hidden treasures." So you see that the author of this book does not like Saul at all. He is a great admirer of David. He does not like King Saul, as if Saul left Agag alive because he was so greedy, he wanted to get all the hidden treasures. And on account of this, he spared him and let him live and brought him to Ramathaim. And God said to Samuel, "You have seen how in a short time the king has been corrupted." Never happens to leaders in our days. Never. "The king has been corrupted with silver and he has let the king of Amalek and his wife," all of a sudden the wife is mentioned, "Shershelapham. And now let them be so that Agag may come together with his wife tonight." Oh, your goodness, yeah. "And you will kill him tomorrow. But his wife, they will keep safe until she bears a male child." You know, everything is well planned. They'll sleep together tonight. She'll get pregnant immediately. 9 months later, she'll have a male. Male offspring. "And then she also will die. And he who will be born from her will become stumbling block for Saul." So you see that when we heard in chapter 65 that Samuel has said it, he has said it in this book, not in the book of Samuel, but in this book, of course. "Now, may you rise up tomorrow and kill Agag, because Saul's sin is written before me all the days." And when Samuel rose up early in the morning, Saul went out to meet him and said to him, "The Lord has delivered our enemies into our hand, just as you have said." And Samuel said to Saul, "How much harm Israel has done because they demanded you for themselves as a king." Again, you see, as we said, Saul did not have a chance since the very beginning. Samuel was so very upset about the people asking for a king, and now he mentions it. What a mistake it was. What a price Israel is paying for asking a king for themselves, because they demanded you for themselves as a king before the time came that the king should rule over them. Meaning they should have waited patiently for David, of course. And you who were sent to do the will of the Lord have transgressed it. And so he who was let live by you will die now. And those hidden treasures, the hidden treasures that he talked about, he will not show you. Never. And one who will be born from him will be for you a stumbling block. And Samuel came to Agag, and he had a sword, and Samuel killed Agag and returned to his house. That's it. So, what we saw, that within the book of Samuel, we have a pro-Saul story, a pro-David story, and the second one considers the fact that perhaps the Amalekite guy was lying to David. And this way, one could keep the two stories, one next to the other, in the book of Samuel. And it's clear that the writer of the second story knew the first story. It's kind of an interpretation of the first story. So whoever tells you that people started interpreting the Bible after they have finished writing the Bible and they were afraid they don't have a job anymore. No, the Bible, as I've already mentioned, people started interpreting the Bible within the Bible. When the first letter in the Bible was written, people were already interpreting it. And then, of course, the book of Chronicles, as we have mentioned, the chronicler had to choose one of the two versions, and surprisingly enough, he chose the one of 1 Samuel 31, and I have tried at least to explain the best way I could why he chose that one and not 2 Samuel 1, which talks highly of David. But he made the necessary changes in order to humiliate King Saul. And then comes Josephus, who compromises between these two stories, and then also Antiquities of the Bible, which comes up with the original idea of giving this guy a name. Yeah, he's the son of Agag. The son of Agag is the one who kills Saul, and we have poetic justice, and we are very happy. Actually, I'm not so happy at all about it, because I still love the story of 1 Samuel chapter 31, which presents Saul as a great tragic hero. And I'm not very happy that this is the end of the series, but thank you for being so very patient with me. Thank you.
This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.